Maria from What's Up Public Health. Today we'll be having a conversation with our great guest,
Lizak Bula,
CEO of Moses Behavioral Care and Senior Placement Services, and a strong community leader and mentor, to talk to us about her career, including how she got to where she is, how social issues have played a role in her career decision-making, and what advice she has for young women leaders. Thank you so much and stay tuned. So thank you so much for taking the time and getting to talk to us and share your experience and your knowledge and wisdom. So in the beginning, if you just want to tell us a little bit about yourself, what you do and how you're doing it and all that good stuff.
Well, Maria, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with your folks. So essentially what I do is every day is a little bit different just because, you know, managing, you know, several different companies, and they're all family-based companies, but still managing several different companies just has its own challenges in general. But, you know, our family, we own Moses Behavioral Care, which is a group of mental health facilities that provide 24-hour services for anyone living with serious mental illness. We also run our nonprofit Senior Placement Services, which goes into the community and determines what needs are associated with the members that are either, you know, veterans that are homeless, folks that are living again with serious mental illness, or just the elderly who are unable to access the care and resources needed to live, you know, independently or even with assisted care. And the last agency is our staffing agency. We just launched it about 3 months ago, and it's something we've been trying to do for quite some time, but the pandemic really pushed us to make that decision and go ahead and, you know, and launch that. So we provide healthcare staffing to various agencies around the states, and also obviously staffing for our own companies as well.
Wow, thank you. That's quite a lot of work, especially right now in healthcare with the pandemic. It's definitely, I think, been a hurdle to get everything done, and some things have been pushed back. But thank you for your contribution too to healthcare. So based on your background and experience, what would you say geared you or interested you in community health field work? Because I think, at least for me, when I started my career, and I'm still a young career professional, was that I first thought I wanted to do one thing, and then all of a sudden I was like, wait, you know what? I don't think so. Yeah. And so how'd you get that? How'd you get inspired, and how'd your interest in community health field start?
Well, it certainly wasn't planned. I wanted to go into fashion for so long. And, you know, after being in that industry, I ended up being a buyer, or a junior buyer, I should say, at Nordstrom. And I realized, like, they don't make any money. This is bad. So I was in college and I can't do this. And so I quickly pivoted, and I ended up getting my degree in business, which is a generic degree for a lot of us that don't know what we want to do just yet. So I kind of dived into that, and I thought maybe I'd go into real estate or something of that sort. But I ended up in education, which is certainly not within my area of expertise at the time. And I just kind of landed in that role. I didn't like it. I really didn't. It really didn't feed me. And, you know, when you're doing a job that, you know, you're great at, but it really doesn't serve you, or it doesn't really serve your community, you kind of have to make a change. And that's exactly what happened. I would say about nine or 10 years ago or so, my parents, they were volunteering at the hospital. My dad's a pastor. And so, you know, and also obviously my mom's is a pastor's wife, and, you know, everything that they do is just in service to others. And as immigrants, you know, when we first moved to this country, one of the things that we realized was a huge benefit to us was a community that kind of rallied around us. And it was odd, you know, it wasn't just your own community or the community that, you know, that looks like you, but it was just this group of just amazing folks that just wanted to make sure that you succeeded. And, you know, in doing that, we saw that growing up. It's me and my siblings, there are four of us. And we knew whatever we did, we had to somehow, you know, essentially pay it forward. And when my parents, they were volunteering at this hospital in Tempe, they'd notice that the folks that, you know, they kind of read to, and, you know, they kind of walk around the, you know, the hallways and things, you know, just for, you know, not necessarily PT, just kind of, they were, I don't know what you call them now. It's not quarterlies, but something similar like that, right? So they'd notice that these same folks would, you know, end up outside in front of the doors. And my mom eventually asked, I think it was one of the managers at the time, hey, what's going on? Like, you know, we just discharged this person, or we're just reading to this person. He's discharged and now he's sitting outside. Like, what's going on with him? Does he need to come back in? And they're like, no, they kind of use the hospital as a respite, especially in the summertime. And so a lot of these folks obviously were homeless. They had some, obviously too, some mental health concerns. But what was striking the most for us was that we found out that most of them were veterans, and that was really aching. We don't have a strong connection to the VA, or we don't have, you know, veterans in our families or anything of that nature, but it's right is right, right? Yeah. And, you know, knowing that these folks, they did everything they can to sacrifice so that we can be who we are today, and they're sitting outside of a hospital in need of housing or whatever it just seemed wrong. And at the time, my parents were volunteering here. I was working at Gannett. I was a director of learning and development there. So it was a very demanding job, lots going on, tons of travel. I think I was still, pregnant with my daughter. And I was just, me and my mom were talking one day, and she was just like, we have to do something. I was like, that's kind of messed up, mom. I was like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, there's something we can do. And so after I'd given birth to my daughter, maybe I hadn't given birth to her yet. I can't remember the exact timeline. But around that time, I quit my job. I quit my job. I moved in with my mom, and we started this nonprofit. So that's essentially how we got started.
Wow. So actually, this sort of brings me to the next question. Exactly how you ended is sort of how did you learn to embrace risk taking and sort of balancing, okay, the pros and the cons, and think, because I think a lot of people, and especially in the beginning of their careers, and it happened to me without a doubt, was that it was like scary, right? To just sort of make a decision and think, well, I just spent so much money on this degree, or I just spent so many years over here. I've known a lot of people that sort of are like, you know what, whatever, I'm just going to continue doing it because I did it for 4 years now. And you know what, forget it, I'll continue. So how did you embrace that risk taking and know, like, was it like a gut feeling that you were just like, okay, yes, this is good? Or how'd you sort of embrace that?
You know, when you've been in a field, and I think at that time, I'd probably been in L&D for maybe 10 years or so. And maybe less than that, but about 8 to 10 years. And you know, when you're in a job that's not your job, that you're just kind of holding a place for somebody else, you know it. So just like that same feeling when you find that job that you know is right for you, you know that as well. And that's kind of what happened. You know, I just kind of realized, said, this makes me feel, I'm doing this for free, and I feel better doing this for free than doing this and I'm getting paid for it. And I'm not one to, you know, if I'm just being transparent, I'm not one to, you know, sacrifice my financial welfare, you know, just to, you know, go out and start a random, you know, nonprofit, or, you know, to, you know, maybe live in a very undesirable, like, lifestyle for the greater good. And I'll tell you why, because I need, you know, when you're doing something, you need to be happy about what it brings to you and what you're doing for your community. And I knew that I needed to have that balance. And that's just me knowing I had to be honest with myself. And so, and you know, in starting the business, one of the things that we really looked at was there a financial opportunity to make this happen? Because the goal was to grow it. And if we weren't profitable, we couldn't grow it. And if, you know, if we weren't bringing in an income, we couldn't build facilities, we couldn't build hospitals, we can't expand. And so it wasn't so much of a, you know, a knee-jerk reaction. It was definitely very well thought out, but we just knew it was the right thing to do. You know, why it was so easy for me to up and leave? I have family, and you know, risks are difficult when you're doing them on your own. And I wasn't burdened with that. And you know, I was just having my daughter, I was gonna be a single mom. I was going through a divorce, and you know, all of those things are scary at the same time. And I was like, why not just pile one more thing on top of it? It's not going to make that big of a difference. And my parents are amazing. And, you know, I have 4 siblings, and you know, everybody's so supportive. And I think at one point or the other, we've all lived with one another. And, you know, our family were really, really close. So this was helpful. This was an easy decision for me to make just because I knew I had the support.
Yeah. And so in regards to everything you had, you mentioned it, right? During that time, you were going to have your daughter divorce. You were already opening a new nonprofit with your family. So how'd you handle it all, mental health wise, the balance of having time for yourself, time for everything else? So, because you're a philanthropist, an entrepreneur, a CEO, a mother, how'd you handle all of these plates?
You know, and I say it, it's that village, right? You know, we talk about how it takes a village to raise a child, but it's not just in childhood. That goes through your adulthood. That same village that helped to raise you are the same ones that helped to grow you. And I've always had that, you know, so the idea of, you know, doing anything on my own is not something that I've ever really had to do. As far as the mental health piece, you know, I think back, and if I wouldn't have written down some of the experiences I had, a lot of those things I forgot. And because you push through it. Sometimes when you're in that much pain and, you know, there's so much going on and so much indecision and, you know, juggling so much, you just push through it. I think when you don't reach that level of success that you're looking for is when you dwell in it. And I didn't have, you know, when you're raising a child, you really don't have the capacity to do that. You know, it's not about you anymore. And, you know, it's about that child that you brought. And that's my, and that she, obviously she's my responsibility. And, you know, I had some of that burden offloaded to my parents as well and my siblings, you know, so it was nice. I mean, it sucked. It really did. It was a terrible, terrible experience.
Gosh, I bet.
At all. I mean, it was a terrible experience. It dragged on for several years. And, you know, sometimes I think back, like when you just kind of have that moment where you're like, oh my God, that did happen, huh?
I went through that.
Yeah. And so I still have those moments for sure. And, you know, we're talking almost 10 years later, but you know, it's, you push through it. You really don't have a choice.
That's really inspirational though to hear, because I think many of the times, exactly, sometimes one goes through hardship and you think like it's difficult. And I think for a lot of people, time passes and you're like, wow, once you look back at it and you're like, wow, I really did go through this. Wow. But some people don't make it sometimes to the other end in the sense of getting out or dwelling through that. So definitely hearing this from someone that's so successful is really inspiring, I must say.
You want to know what it is too, Maria? You know, it wasn't like I was going into this position that was, you know, this glamorous job and I'm looking at all these people that are doing all these amazing things in their lives. But, you know, I'm going out into the homeless population. I'm like, yeah, Liz, your stuff isn't so bad. Shut up. You know, so you certainly put things into perspective very, very quickly when you see this woman who's trying to feed her child and they won't let her into the homeless shelter because children aren't allowed. Now, what do? And I can go home and I can see my child and she's got food and she's got, you know, diapers and, you know, all the necessities. It's just you put things into perspective very quickly.
Yes, I agree. Even myself being in sort of those, seeing that situation, it's definitely reminds you of a lot of things. And
I know your job can be very humbling too. I mean, you work with families, you work with, you know, the mental health population. It's a hard industry.
It is. And I think it takes a lot. Like, you definitely know, it takes a lot of patience, of a lot of little things. And then now yourself having also a child, my poor dog, I come home and I'm like, you guys in the room, you guys, I'm not feeling it today.
That's awesome. It'll get more complicated. Give it a couple more years.
Yeah, right. Right now I can just shush him. I can't shush my child, but I'll shush the dogs. So being a woman of color in a strong male-oriented field in business, could you share with us some of those additional barriers that have come with it and how you've managed it or dealt with it? I think it'd be really helpful for a lot of young women leaders to sort of hear those barriers, because it could be discouraging. It could be discouraging to sit in a room and you have people that are not your color, people that don't understand where you come from or even take the time to understand. And you, to top it all off, you have, I sort of call it the sandwich effect. For example, myself, I say, well, first, I'm an immigrant, I'm Hispanic, I'm a female. Mm-hmm. That's three things topped together that can create additional barriers that can sometimes be discouraging. So yourself, how did you manage it being in such a male-oriented field?
You know, so I'm one of five, and I'm the only girl in my family. And I grew up in a matriarch. My mom is probably the strongest person I've ever met in my life. And, you know, when you see that as an example, obviously we're all going to have burdens and struggles, but my mother was, you know, always our biggest cheerleaders. And, you know, I watched her fight for us, especially as immigrants, you know, growing up in New York City, growing up in the 80s during the crack epidemic, you know, we're living in, you know, project housing. You know, my mom is like, why? I mean, it's just so much going on at that time. And you remember those things, and you remember how your parents just you look at it and you don't realize what they were going through to get us through. You just knew that you got there. And I've always just kind of lived that. And, you know, what you're going through at that moment is relevant to you, but in the grand scheme of things, it's so irrelevant in regards to what's going to happen tomorrow. And, you know, just kind of understanding that my end goal is my end goal, my failures and, you know, the folks that, you know, didn't want to see me succeed, that helps to fuel you. If you use that as a method of rage or as a method of, you know, I'm not good enough, you know, that syndrome of I shouldn't have a seat in this room, that's what's going to happen. But if you use those failures and you use those naysayers as like your fuel, it gets you so much further. And it doesn't come without hurt. Obviously it does. I mean, some of the things that I've heard people say about me, my family, you know, like, you know, are deserving of success or why we feel we have the right to XYZ. I mean, all of those things you hear people say to your face, you know, people tell people that, you know, that know you, and it hurts. And that's it, but that's life. You know, there's so many other things that can be painful. These are people that don't know you. And what they say about you is so irrelevant. In that moment, it does feel like everything's just gonna to fall down, but it never does. And that's what makes, I feel like, our family story, you know, just so incredible for me. You know, I've had, even minus the race issue, but I had a meeting with a gentleman, I would say right before the pandemic. And he was a Middle Eastern gentleman too, which was kind of shocking to me. And he had asked me, he was like, Liz, are you married? And I said, no. He was like, that's going to hurt you. I said, excuse me?
Interesting. Well done.
He was like, that's gonna really, really hurt. He was like, consider just putting a ring on. He was like, this industry is not, he was like, I'm not saying you're not gonna succeed. He said, but there's gonna be a lot of folks who don't want you to succeed, especially being a single woman and you're Black in Arizona. He was like, consider wearing a ring. I was like, Jesus Christ. I was like, that's a new one.
Escalated quick. Oh my God. I don't know how I would react to that.
You know, so I know one thing. If you allow folks to continue to talk, they will tell you exactly who they are. And one of the things that I feel has allowed us to be successful in this field is that we go into it without judgment. And being in the mental health field, you know, if you come in with preconceived notions about who people are and what they should do and how they should behave, you know, I don't see how success can be in your future. And I've kind of, you know, used that methodology in any meeting that I walk into. You know, I walk into a lot of meetings on a blank slate, and I try not to, it's going to sound bad because I know you're supposed to research the folks that you're sitting with, but in that research, it typically comes with a lot of bias.
Yep.
You know, things that they've done and things that may not be favorable to your cause and so on and so forth. So it's really hard to, you know, to research somebody without coming into that meeting with the preconceived notion of who they are. And, you know, if someone referred me to that person, I would kind of ask my friend, like, hey, you know, what does this person do? Just give me some background, not so much like their opinions about them, but the factual information that I need just to make the meeting a bit more successful. And I found that that's really helped me. So, you know, just kind of, and again, in all transparency, I've been 40 for the last I don't know, 5 years. I'm not even 40 yet, but I, you know, people ask, I can't think of a meeting where I've sat down with a man for work and he has not asked me how old I am. And so I learned that that in itself was going to be a barrier. So I was like, okay, I'm 40. And they're like, oh my God, really? I'm like, yeah, really? Like, why is this a conversation? But sure, let's go with it. And so, I mean, I do feel like, you know, obviously to your age, I mean, you know, you're young, you know, you're moving up and people are going to challenge that. And, you know, to a degree that, you know, they should, because when you walk into a hospital room and your doctor looks like he's 12, you're going to be like, like, when did you graduate? Right. So, you know, we have to understand that the same biases that folks have, we have them too. They're just displayed differently.
Yeah. I mean, and then there's a lot of, when you mentioned the research thing, I mean, there's a lot of implicit bias, even if people don't think they're being biased, you have that implicit bias where you'll go in already with a perceived notion. And a lot of things too is there's different cultures out there. Mm-hmm. I have a husband who's Indian, and definitely, and I'm Mexican. So we definitely have very different, well, actually, surprisingly enough, we have a lot of similarities.
Yeah, you would.
If that we would. Really, really, really dig deep into it, and him and I have, but I've always remembered that exactly the same thing is that people already come with their own thoughts. And it's true. I mean, if you have a doctor that looks super young, your instinct is just going to be that. It may not be out of fault or out of intentionality, but that's just what they ask for. Now, I think it is audacious for men to always be asking one's age.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Cause that's just, some things just don't belong in the conversations at all.
Oh, I know. But you know what? So, and that kind of goes back to your original question. You know, how do you deal with all of it? You just do.
Because I just want to grab them and be like, you know what? Walk, shoo.
And at some point, I feel like you can reach a point in your career where you can do that. But when you're still building, sometimes it's just easier. Not even just easier. It's the smart thing to do to let them live in their own ignorance. Because not everyone is receptive to your gift of knowledge. Not yet. Especially when they're sitting in a seat that can drive your future. So restraint is something I've had to hone moving to Arizona from a large city.
Yeah, very multicultural city from that matter, multicultural state.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, you know, just knowing what to say and when to say it, and almost more importantly, when to say it. So yeah.
It's definitely a skill, I'd say, that takes practice.
It does.
I myself, I'm just, 5 years into my career, and I've definitely, in the beginning of my career, I think I learned it the hard way. I was very, very straightforward, and I didn't learn that lesson you're talking of till later on. And later on, I realized, you know what, it's just not my moment right now.
Yeah. And sometimes you have to ask, is correcting this person worth this woman losing her housing? It's all about pride and ego, and it's not worth it.
Yeah. So going on to the next question, it's sort of in the same area, but a little bit more in regards to the social issue. So in the past, I mean, not even the past, by the past, I mean this past year, last year, that towards the end of last year, and just a few weeks ago, we've had a lot of events, explicit racism events, systemic racism, systemic bias. It could be called a lot of things nowadays. But most notorious was the death of Breonna Taylor. And recently, right now, is the trial of George Floyd. The closing statements, I believe, were today.
Yeah.
And it's even speaking about it right now, I sort of get chills because we just had a case about a week or two, March 29th, I think it occurred. But the video came on not too long ago, about a 13-year-old that was shot by a police officer while he was running, after getting a call from an attempted burglary. So yourself, how do you manage all of this mentally and make sure that it doesn't interfere with your career and your progress? And if it does, how do you use that to the best of your ability? Because I know a lot of people, and I wish Shamira was here because she would be able to connect to this more, but a lot of people, it really hits home. And at least for me, there was a shooting, I believe, a year or two, I think 2 years ago in a Walmart. And the guy went to shoot all Hispanics. That was his deal. He went into the, it was in Texas. And I definitely,
I remember that.
Yeah. And I definitely will say that it was for me, and there was police at Walmart probably that first week here in Arizona. And for me, it was a little scary to just enter because the thought that I could be shot just because of my race and because somebody thought I did not belong in this country was very, very difficult. Yeah. And still at some times I have to remind myself that I do belong in this country. Mm-hmm. So how have you managed these surrounding issues that are surrounding you, and how have you used it towards a positive experience or a way that you can make a positive experience in the community?
It's been a hard year, I think, for everybody. And, you know, our community obviously has been impacted. And now we have, you know, the Asian population that's, you know, been impacted. In Arizona, there's something very different going on with, you know, how Hispanics are treated versus how they're treated in other parts of the country. And so that was when I was also referencing, you know, moving here from New York. I mean, those are all things that I just didn't have to deal with, you know, and not to this degree, obviously. I mean, everyone deals with something, but, you know, this issue for us has been present in our communities forever. It's another day. For us, it's Tuesday. You know, for everybody else, and I shouldn't say everybody else, but for a lot of communities that are not, you know, typically affected by this, it's a terrible, terrible day, but we've been living with this, you know, and after a certain amount of time, you never get desensitized to someone shooting a child or doing a drive-by and killing, you know, a 10-year-old boy or, you know, and that 13-year-old boy, he had his hands up. He had the gun in his hand and he was raising his hand and he was shot. My daughter, I have her watch, not all of it, but, you know, I have her watch a lot of it, and she's 8 and she wants to know why. And I explain to her why. My daughter's also biracial. She looks Black. Now she does. When she was younger, people used to ask me who I was nannying for, but anyway, so I think, you know, our coping mechanisms, you know, for everything that we're seeing on television has been really, really challenged. Because on top of seeing what we can only assume is our future on television, you still have to walk out of your door and continue to live that. You know, if I see a police officer, it's a different experience from when someone else sees a police officer. You know, everything that I do, I kind of fuel back to my work, and it helps to put things into perspective for me too, because I do have shelter. You know, I'm not on the streets. We picked up a gentleman. He was in the hospital. He'd been in there for about, I don't know, maybe like 2 months. He was in a coma and he was living in Tucson, and they'd like beaten this man like half to death. Black guy. He was maybe like in his, maybe, I don't know, maybe like 40s or so. And I mean, just because he was homeless, so it had nothing to do with the fact that he was Black. But I think about those situations, and I think about, you know, if something were to happen, I mean, where would I go? I have access. And, you know, the folks that we serve, you and I serve, they don't have access, not all the time. And they're completely unsheltered. And there's something about having a roof over your head that gives you comfort. And I know that sounds very basic, but I remember there was a time when I had a home invasion. I wasn't home, and everything around me just felt so violated. You know, I almost didn't even want to be in the house, but then I realized being out of the house was so much worse. And that's what I kind of look at. That's how I look at this situation almost. We have one level of security that another group still does not have. And that's the part for me that's really hard to contend with. And it's not to say that these folks, these men and women that are being shot by the police, you know, they don't have a home, they do, but somehow they were still violated. And I don't know how to contend with that. I really don't. You know, I've had experiences in my own neighborhood. I'm the only, my daughter and I were the only Black family in this neighborhood. And we've had experiences in this neighborhood too. And, you know, sometimes you get the calls and people are angry for you and they want you to do something. And I finally asked my neighbor one time, I said, why don't you do something? I said, this is my everyday. This is your Tuesday. You do something. I'm tired of doing something.
Yeah. So
I think with all of that, I think the only thing that we can do is to talk to each other. And unfortunately, you know, the era of Donald Trump really, really created a huge distance between people.
Yep.
Because I mean, I have tons of, I think most of my friends are Republican, but they're not Trump supporters. And I think that's there's a different type of person. Some of them are, but those are very different types of people. And I think the only way that we can help to combat any of this is just to speak to one another, because there's so much that happens in our communities, in your Hispanic community, my Black community, your husband's Indian community that no one knows about, you know, whether it's, you know, the good, the bad, the sad, all of it. But if we don't talk to each other in a way that's not, you know, that's not malicious, in a way that's not, you know, that's without condemnation, I don't know how else we're going to get through this, because you can't do it by yourself. You know, nope. We live in a neighborhood, and, you know, Sal, one of the things that he always says is you're only as healthy as the person standing next to you. And that goes the same for happiness. You know, that goes the same for justice. That goes the same for civil rights. You know, if your neighbor is feeling a certain way about you because of who you are, it affects you. How can it not affect you?
Yep.
So, yeah, I mean, I talk to my friends. I'm not one of those types of folks that, you know, I have specific friends that I can and can't talk to about certain things, or I feel like there's a place and time for something. I think there's a place and time for everything. And if my life is at stake, if I feel, you know, someone is saying something that would affect the future of my daughter or someone else's daughter, you have to say something. And, you know, at dinner parties, you're not supposed to talk about certain topics at dinner parties. And how do we learn from each other if we can't even do it at a place that's supposed to bring, you know, subtlety and happiness and humility at a dinner table? I don't know how else we do that. But, you know, it has been interesting. Like I said, I grew up in New York during the crack epidemic. And I mean, that was not a great time to be there. And this obviously is a very different scale. But I mean, they had Black men in body bags, you know, 50 times a day down there. It was unreal. So, and you kind of felt like you were living in a war zone, and I was young. So this is obviously very different, but those same emotions, they kind of rush back, because they're still killing your people. But we have to talk to each other. That's my main thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that a lot of the times we think that, or the community, especially people that are not in one's shoes, thinks that the problems will just fix themselves. Just give it time. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that a lot, whether just give it time, people will stop doing it, or people will do something. And obviously, if you don't talk about these topics, if you don't bring these topics up, it's nothing. Time actually will not do anything when it comes to these topics. And many of the times, people, like you mentioned, don't want to talk about it. I myself try to, my husband and I usually talk about these topics as well, because we want to, when something happens in my community or in his community or another community that we identify with, in the sense of minorities, immigrants, him and I both being immigrants, we always talk about it because we want to know what we're both thinking. And also because I, at least for me, I do think as well that there is a time and place for everything. And I do like to hone on those times and try and spread the word in a way when it's possible. Now, I've had incidents where I talk about it and then immediately, even with my own relatives, that they'll just be like, well, no, not right now. That's too political. Mm-hmm. But I think, like you mentioned, that is the issue sometimes, is that we don't talk about it. And right now, there's the media. Now we see it more often. That's one thing too, is that we see it more often. But like you mentioned, minority communities like yourself, like mine, we've always gone through these things. Yeah. Only that I didn't have CNN or ABC News filming all the time. Yeah, now it's being filmed all the time. DACA, for example, DACA is an issue that's been on for years and years, since the Obama era. Mm-hmm. I had to write an article about how controversial it was back in 20, 2012 or 2014. Right. And but now the thing is that it's getting more press, and I think the Trump era, like you mentioned, added more fire to the fuel. I think people just got confidence if the person with one of the highest power in the world is saying this, because even myself, there was a point where he said that Mexicans were rapists and were criminals. And I was in my master's program at that time. And I can definitely say I felt the vibe of people just saying things to me, giving me looks, or if I'd sit, they'd go somewhere else. I was even insulted once for speaking Spanish in my own school. So definitely, like you mentioned, that era did add fire to the fuel. But like, I agree, the most important thing to do is to talk about it, even though everybody says, no, don't.
You know, Maria, what's interesting too about what happened over the last 4 years is, you know, sometimes God will allow the devil to do his work, right? And I'm not saying this man is the devil, right? But he certainly was not a man who brought peace. And when you have somebody with that loud of a megaphone spewing hate, people will speak. And that's what he did. He did. He allowed something that could have been swept under the rug for the next 20 years. He brought it to the forefront because, I mean, he fueled it. And the people could do nothing but fight back. I'm not saying I'm thankful for the guy, but what he brought to media was something that media did not have to discuss. And because he kept putting it in front of us, they had no choice but to speak. Now we have no choice but to react. Now we have no choice but to change legislation, because now you see the injustice that's really woven into, you know, our legal system, our housing system, you know, our employment situation, because he's saying it's fair. And people are like, well, that doesn't happen. They're like, yes, yes, it does. So he allowed a voice that was sleeping for a long time to be awoken. Just like when Obama became president. Again, these are issues that people stop talking about. People stop talking about a lot of injustice. People stop talking about, you know, why can't these kids stay in school? Like, they've been here. What is the big deal? Let them stay in school. And we get this black president who has this black attorney general. He's suing people. He's trying to put people in jail. And we're like, what's going on? And so, you know, even just not just the last 4 years, but just the last 12 years. And we had a black man in office, then they put a racist in office. I mean, how much more polarizing do you get? How do you not talk about that? Right? Yeah.
It was extremely polarizing. It was to a certain extent. It was awestruck-ing, to be honest. I was just like, wow, we went from A to Z very, very quickly.
Yeah.
And it was just tough for me to sort of see how everything was unfolding, during the past 4 years. But I agree. I mean, if you really think about it, that's sort of what happened, is that people, it's not that the issues were not there. It's that the issue started to come out because of everything that happened the last 4 years. Mm-hmm. It wasn't the first time that I was discriminated at school per se. It was just happened to be that it was happening more and that media was showing it. Mm-hmm. At least that was an example to give. But at the end of the day, I guess I'd say that it was, if you want to take all of the positives from the negatives, it was actually good that happened, because now you're seeing great people in legislation, yourself, we're seeing people in a lot of areas.
Look at what happened to the House. I mean, look at the demographic of women that entered politics, right? The number of minorities that entered politics because of this man. So, I mean, if he wants to take credit for that, that's perfect. Then your hate is what's producing more good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of people obviously were hurt, people were killed, you know, people lost their jobs. You know, so many things happened in that 4 years that he was president. But we all know that if not for his presidency, these conversations would not be happening right now.
Exactly. And thank you for sharing that. I know that's very, a lot of information and a lot of things to share, and a difficult topic to really discuss. But thank you for discussing it with us and sharing your thoughts. So before we close, I wanted to see if there's any piece of advice, or what piece of advice would you give young women in starting their careers, particularly young minority women, women of color, that like mentioned, we do have those extra barriers that are present. What would you say is an advice or tip that you would give them?
One of the things that I've discovered over, you know, many years of just researching the topic of, you know, wage inequalities between men and women, or, you know, between various races, is that the disparity in wages for women, they really doesn't happen until they've started having children. In fact, that number goes up about 20%, the wage gap in a woman's 30s, typically at her childbearing ages. And, you know, with everything that I know that I'm working on, you know, as a mom, as a business owner, as a, you know, as a sister, as, you know, everything else I am to everyone else in my life, you know, I have to consider, you know, am I doing something that's serving my daughter? And, you know, sometimes I work 16 hour days, and for me, that's okay. You know, the conversation that I have with my daughter is very different from what, you know, maybe a mom or dad that's a couple even would have with their child. You know, mommy has to work because mommy wants to make the community better, not just for the people that are living there today, but also for you. And, you know, that's what you have to do too. And, you know, I work with my daughter. She'll be here with me. Sometimes she's running around, you know, while I'm on conference calls, it happens. But that's what it means to just to be a part of a community, to be a part of society. I can't shield my entire life because I have a job, but I'm not going to feel bad because I have a job. Now, it's okay to feel bad. There's nothing wrong with that. But what your child sees is what they're going to project. So if your child sees guilt, they're going to think you're guilty. If your child, you know, they see that you're sad, I mean, they fall into depression. I mean, depression right now with children is so high because they're hearing about this pandemic, and they're hearing about staying at home, and they're hearing about, you know, people losing their jobs, and they're hearing those things from their parents, and that's what they project. My daughter, I'm not saying that I'm a perfect mom, trust me, I have a lot of issues, you know, but my daughter is never, those are not conversations we have. And I ask her, but she doesn't see that I project that. And so, you know, as we're talking about women that are entering the field and they're thinking, you know, do I want to have a child or do I want to have a career? The answer is you don't have to choose, you know, because the opportunities are available to do both. It's not going to be easy, obviously, especially if you're doing it on your own, or even if you do have a spouse, you know, who's going to stay at home, who's making more money, you know, all those things. If you don't want your path to be just a mother doing all the hard work that comes with mothering, you have the option to do both. And, you know, I've watched a lot of women limit their career paths because they felt like it would affect their ability to be good moms. And I just want to say that it doesn't have to. It doesn't have to. It's your choice as to what you make your family dynamics look like. So, you know, ideally, if it's something you want, obviously do it. If you just want to be a mom and that's what fuels you, be a mom. You're gonna be a great mom, you know, but if you want to do both, you can be great at both too. And it's unfortunate because I even hate that I have to bring it up because, you know, there are so many disparities between, you know, men and women in the workplace already. Yep. But then how do you deal with the fact that you're a mom and you've got soccer practice and all this other stuff? I just tell my kid, like, I don't have time. I can't take you to dance. In fact, we're not doing dance this year. And I'll tell you why, but we can dance at home, you know? You know, you don't want to crush their dreams without an alternative. Dance with mommy at home. I'll bring your cousins over too. So, you know, it's just a matter of choice. And that's all.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Because it definitely is a topic that it comes up. And I've known even employers, which actually baffles me, that will ask, like, well, are you going to have kids? And it's one of those questions that I think, like we mentioned, is not in the place, in the right place of people to ask. But people ask, well, will you get pregnant? Because obviously they see the economic standpoint. Okay, they have to take time off, then they'll have a kid, they'll want flexibility, which is the workforce has not adapted yet, at least not in the US.
So the most natural thing that happens.
Or the most natural thing, yes, the most natural thing there is in this planet.
Right.
And what makes the planet run and what actually gives the economy back.
Yes,
if you really think about it, the workforce has not acclimated to it. So thank you. Thank you for that piece of advice. Thank you for answering the questions. And we're really excited to have you on the pod.
Thank you so much for having me. And again, you know, appreciate everything that you do for the community as well.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today. And make sure to follow us on Twitter at WhatUpPH. Or email us at whatsuppublichealth@gmail.com if you have any topics that you would like for us to cover. Please don't forget to leave us a 5-star rating wherever you listen to us. Until next time, thanks for listening.